The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi, folks. That first wonderful voice that you heard belongs to my wife, Sarita, and that second voice that you heard belongs to my once close friend and for a man with whom I worked for about 4.5 years, Francis Sinatra. And this is a voice of John Barber coming to you from Las Vegas, which is just on the outskirts of John Barber's world. It has been a very eventful newsmaking couple of weeks, the first of which was clouded up with footage about Bruce Jenner, who I believe is going to be on the cover of Time magazine as Man and Woman of the Year. Anyway, he finally came out of the closet admitting he was a Republican. Another one with no balls. Anyway, the interesting thing and the weird thing is that he said he has always preferred women, which is what he told every one of his wives, even though he always felt like one inside. And he says he will continue to prefer them. In other words, he is having a sex change operation to become a lesbian. God, what meaningless television. Speaking of meaningless television, this is the last month on CBS for David Letterman. Now, this is just my opinion. It may be a very astute one, a very intelligent, well-informed one, but it is still just my opinion. In the 33 years that David Letterman was a late-night host, he never introduced the television. A fraction of the intelligence, talent, entertainment, and meaningfulness as did Jack Parr in just 5 short years. David, as a monologist in interview, was at best just ordinary. He was the perfect, mildly amusing distractor in a society that now only demands excellence from its athletes. At one time, some of you might remember this, over a dozen years ago, he had on one of America's best and brightest comics, Bill Hicks, in a class, the top of the class, with Lenny Bruce and George Carlin. Then after the taping, cut him out of the broadcast show. 2 years ago, he apologized and aired the segment after Hicks had died. He is another example of a prominent TV personality like Bill O'Reilly, who sexually prey on female employees and retain their making money for the company jobs, which 40 or 50 years ago, I assure you, ended the careers of a number of such perverts and predators. Letterman won't be missed by me as much as I miss my mother, the car. And speaking of athletes and more meaningless bread and circuses television, the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight took place here in Las Vegas Saturday night. The most profitable ballyhooed fight in history. But for fans of real fighters, it was like ballyhooing the Super Bowl played by two high school teams. I assure you, I see better fights every night now during the National Hockey League Stanley Cup playoffs. And Mayweather's take was over $160 million. It was a decision, not a knockout. And the reason Mayweather couldn't knock out Pacquiao, because he couldn't hit him as hard as he hit his wife. A year ago, he was arrested for spousal abuse and got away with it. Mayweather is a man or a boxer. Is nowhere near the class or ability of either Sugar Ray Robinson, Sugar Ray Leonard, and certainly nowhere near the giant of them all, Muhammad Ali. If Mayweather was a city, he'd be Baltimore. As a matter of fact, the best fight was the one between the mother and her kid, her hoodie kid who was rioting that's gone viral and that we've all seen. You know, when I was a kid living in Canada, I was always surprised when people were evil. Now that I'm older and living in America, I'm surprised when people are good. And that's why I rushed to book a boy genius named Ray Price 2 weeks ago. He's the CEO of his own company called Gravity Cards. He made major news around the world 2 weeks ago, doubling the salaries of his employees to a minimum, I believe, of $70,000. It was a story too good to be true, like a Frank Capra movie with Jimmy Stewart. Well, Friday, I had a lengthy, lovely, delightful phone chat with his communications director, who told me Dan's amazing American story, which you would have heard from Dan tonight himself, except an emergency has caused him to postpone that interview for a couple of weeks. And at first I thought, golly, what a bummer. But you know, it's not, because the second half of Dan's show, I wanted to talk about the economy. And there's nobody better to talk about the economy than my guest tonight. And he's been on the show before, and you absolutely loved him. And he is a person who can tell not just one story, but literally hundreds of them, 5 days a week. He puts out the best newsletter in the business, to me even better than the Drudge Report, which as a right-wing blog is often just that, a drudge. News Vandal, however, which is what his newsletter is called, to paraphrase the New York Times, is, quote, all the news that needs to be read, unquote. He has also made one of the best documentaries I have ever seen about America, featuring Chris Hedges and Naomi Klein and Naomi Wolf, amongst others. He's a two-time Emmy winner and co-host with James Moore, his own terrific show every Friday on KRUU-FM in Iowa. Joe Satilli is his name, and he is my guest, thankfully, for this hour. Joe, terrific to talk to you. I just love chatting with you. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John, for inviting me on. And I was just wondering, when did you want me to come by and wash your windows?
Anyway, speaking, your News Vandal today is really, really interesting. And maybe we could touch on a money story, since I mentioned that Mayweather was getting $160 million for not even knocking out Pacquiao. And you have two terrific stories about somebody else who was monumentally overpaid. One of them is a story about Bill Clinton and his speaking engagement fees. Now, you can either expand on the Mayweather mayhem, and then you can lead us into Bill Clinton.
Well, you know, you had a lot in your introduction. I could also make something of a case for poor David Letterman. You know, he did have a slightly different act or shtick when he was late night on NBC, and then when he goes to CBS and goes into the mainstream, he certainly did soften up his act. But just to be fair to Dave, it's a really high bar to try and come close to the great Jack Parr. I don't think anybody will ever be able to touch Jack Parr. You're sort of asking a midget to dunk a basketball if you're asking Dave Letterman to match Jack Parr, wouldn't you say?
Well, you know, probably that's true in two counts. First of all, there are no more personalities like Jack Parr. And secondly, I don't think a network would hire a Jack Parr.
Right.
So, you know, maybe it's not David's fault. It's just visual wallpaper, a moving wallpaper when you're looking at shows like that. I have never, ever seen more than 5 minutes of the 33 years that he's been on the air, and definitely not after what he did to Bill Hicks. And Bill was an absolute genius. I mean, if he hadn't died at 33, he'd have been much bigger than either Lenny Bruce or George Carlin.
Well, and wouldn't you say that on some level, interviewing is something of a lost art, particularly in television, maybe overall in broadcast? There are some good interviewers here and there on radio, you being among them. But, you know, I think if you look at somebody like a Charlie Rose, who is constantly taking the interviewee's answers and making them an opportunity for him to grandstand about his own knowledge, or, you know, at least on some level, Larry King would occasionally try and probe and ask an interesting question. But again, a lot of Larry King's show was about Larry King. You know, Leno was not much of an interviewer. He was really doing a shtick or a stand-up bit, sitting down. And his stand-up, his sitting down was almost as plain as his stand-up. You know, I'm not really sure.
I'll tell you who was a great interviewer, though. David Susskind.
Oh, well, see, but now you're going back to the 70s. You're going back to PBS. You know, I know that you have your own opinions about Dick Cavett, but Dick Cavett would probe somebody. I think he had Groucho Marx on for a full hour, you know, and there were probing questions, and he would ask interesting questions from time to time. And you got a sense of the person that he was talking to, not necessarily the, you know, the wit and repartee available to the interviewer, which is what a lot of these guys try and prove. As to Mayweather-Pacquiao, I couldn't watch it, didn't want to watch it. I had a friend who wanted to watch it, and I said, I can't justify giving my money to a serial abuser of women. And your point is right to the point of why I couldn't bother. And frankly, it seems to me that boxing has kind of died as a sport.
How did it get such a large audience? I don't understand that. Oh, and speaking of interviewers, we should also probably take a hats off or tip our hat to Mike Wallace, who did a daytime show, and Phil Donahue.
Well, there you go. Excellent.
And Phil Donahue had the highest rated show on MSNBC when they fired him because the president of MSNBC said he doesn't wave the flag enough.
Right. Right. And you know, maybe this is all leading toward it, because I think a lot of Mayweather-Pacquiao was that it was all flag waving. And I think what has happened in the media is that we've really gotten to this post-Paddy Chayefsky moment where it is completely style over substance, and the desire of people to team or to run over a cliff after whatever the promotion is. You can promote a whole team of lemmings over a cliff in this culture, and everybody just wants to be a part of whatever it is everybody's supposed to be a part of, the substance or the quality of what that event is notwithstanding. In a way, I kind of liken it to the Super Bowl. And now the Super Bowl, there have been some good Super Bowl games over the last 10, 15 years, but the game itself has taken second billing to the commercials.
You're absolutely right. You're right. They promo the commercials and the cost of the commercials more than they do the game. And one last thing about the Pacquiao fight. The thing that I loved most about it is that almost every Filipino in America who had a satellite dish did not have to pay the $100 pay-per-view fee, because Pacquiao saw to it that the people in his country, in the Philippines, would be able to watch the fight free. So they had to beam it over to the Philippines, and those Filipinos in America who had satellite dishes all intercepted the signal and saw the party for nothing.
Well, and maybe that is part of what the draw was for some people, is that Floyd Mayweather, who I've listened to a lot of hoo-ha and blah, 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 blather today from sports. You know, sometimes when I'm doing the rundown in the morning, I turn on the local sports talk radio because I am a fan of baseball and basketball and sometimes want to hear. And a lot of the talk is about how Floyd Mayweather is one of the great technical fighters of all time, but he's not a people's champion like Muhammad Ali was or whatnot. I think some people were tuning in hoping to see Mayweather get his block knocked off, because he's not a sympathetic figure. He's actually the opposite of a sympathetic figure. And say what you will about Manny Pacquiao, he is a man of his people.
Yes.
He is perhaps maybe the most up there with Apolinario Aguinaldo, and there's a Filipino history reference for you, John, who led a revolt against the Americans after the Spanish-American War, one of the great freedom fighters in the history of the Philippines. He is one of like the three or four most famous Filipinos in the history of the Philippines. So, you know, there was a little bit of that in there. Here's a terrible segue, but boy, we got to talk about Bill Clinton, because
yes.
Well, the story today is about his relationship with a guy named Frank Giustra, and Frank Giustra is a Canadian mining magnate who has given millions upon millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation, has ended up on the board of the Clinton Foundation, jet sets around the world on his private jet with Bill Clinton all the time. And oh, by the way, at one key point, when Hillary Clinton was at the Department of State, his mining company and his mining interests had some mining and oil interests in the country of Colombia. Now, Colombia, a long embattled country, the United States has poured a lot of money in there, something called Plan Colombia, which began to be formulated under Clinton and took off under the second President Bush. I think that's considering we may get a third President Bush or a second President Clinton. And, you know, inside Colombia, there has long been a war between the government's drug dealers and the FARC, the non-government drug dealers, to control cocaine fields there, and the cocaine production, the coca fields. And the civil war has sort of wound down over time. There are still discussions going on between FARC and the government. But during Hillary's tenure there, the state oil company was also battling labor unions. And that's been one of the targets of the right-wing death squads, by the way, that Chiquita Banana was paying for, right, was to go after labor leaders. Well, labor leaders there was a crackdown organized by the mining interests and by and the oil interest and by the government of these unionized workers and workers who wanted to be unionized. And it turned into a bit of a kerfuffle. Well, these union organizers and labor leaders and human rights activists go to the State Department and they say, hey, look at what's going on in Colombia. Can you please help us? Instead of doing so, what they did, the State Department, was praise Colombia for its human rights record and rubber stamp more aid. And essentially, in a rubber stamp for Colombia, by giving the United States its imprimatur on what Colombia was doing, helped make the way for the oil and gas deal that Frank Giustra had a huge interest in. Now, is there any quid pro quo that money, the $32 million, I think, at that time that he gave to the Clinton Foundation to get on the board, had anything to do with Hillary Clinton's State Department turning a blind eye to a crackdown on labor leaders and activists?
Do you really think, Joe, that Hillary Clinton could be elected?
Yeah, of course she could. You look at it this way, John. It's a win-win for Wall Street.
Let me ask you a second question then. If you were Jeb Bush, let's say you're the Republican candidate, and supposedly you hate Hillary Clinton, there is a clip of Hillary Clinton that clearly depicts the banality and the evil in the heart of this woman. This is a clip shot in North Africa. It is just after the United States murdered Gaddafi. You may remember the clip.
I know this clip.
Tell me what the clip said.
Well, where she says, you know, it's basically she says, you know, hooray, we got him. It was unconfirmed. She was sitting down for an interview. I'm thinking it was with... It wasn't with Savannah Guthrie. It was maybe Diane Sawyer.
But she said, we saw, he died.
Yep. Right.
Now, if you were Jeb Bush, would you have the balls to play that clip on network television during a debate and say, Hillary, did you really mean to laugh at the murder of that man?
And she could probably get away with saying some version of yes. Because, John, since the United States led from behind, as everybody accused the Obama administration of doing, and making NATO do the dirty work of taking out Gaddafi, about 50,000 Libyans have died. There are two governments now competing, one in Tobruk and one in Tripoli. And then there's another sort of set of interests in Benghazi. But Benghazi, by the way, is a port town, and there have been a lot of weapons that went out of Libya after Gaddafi was toppled. A lot of weapons went out of that port of Benghazi into Syria, and that's a trail that's never been picked up on. And I've been fascinated that Republicans, in their desire to pin Benghazi on Hillary Clinton, have never really gone down that road. And I think it's because that's one of those roads you're not allowed to go down. As for the supposed potential hatred between Bush and Clinton, the Bush and Clinton families could not be closer. I think it was in 2004, Barbara Bush said that Bill was like a son to her, like the lost son she never had. Poppy Bush, I like to call him Poppy because I think there's something wonderfully innocuous about a guy that his nickname is Poppy, who has never, you know, the CIA refuses to confirm or deny that George Herbert Walker Bush was ever in the CIA, but we did happen to name our building after him. It's the George Herbert Walker. It's like naming Yankee Stadium after Wally Pipp.
Well, maybe he got that name not because he's a father, but because it's one of the favorite plants that he grows.
Yes, that's very true.
In light of the fact that the Bushes and the Clintons are this century's Hatfields and McCoys, for crying out loud, do you then think that the running of Bernie Sanders is just to a sop to the handful of remaining true liberals or the handful of true progressives left in America, just a sop to them that is absolutely meaningless and will have nothing to do with the outcome of the election?
Think about how perfect it is for Hillary. I mean, this lines up. Elizabeth Warren follows through with her promise that she would not run for president. I think that is exactly what the Hillary campaign wanted, because I think actually Elizabeth Warren might be able to defeat Hillary Clinton, particularly in Iowa and absolutely in New Hampshire.
I believe it too.
Totally beatable by Elizabeth Warren. So then instead you get a socialist, a guy who says he's a socialist. I'm not deriding socialism. I'm just saying he says he's a socialist. And in this version of America, where we're still talking about socialists and communists as if it's an actual thing, and calling Obama a socialist and a communist when all he really did was pave the way for Wall Street to become the dominant, helped pave the way for Wall Street to become the dominant political player in America today. I will tell you this, John, and this, I know that you know a lot about this. I do not think that the military-industrial complex is the dominant sector in American politics. I think the financial-industrial complex has taken over. I think 2008 and the crash actually became a leverage point by which it was able to exert ultimate power and put the military-industrial complex in second place, or maybe even third place between the financial-industrial complex, oil, and then comes the military.
You want to know something, Joe? That's an absolutely brilliant observation. You know, you may be absolutely right about that.
It's Wall Street now. And Wall Street, because of the engine of financialization by which producing things is no longer what America does. What America does is it buys and sells debt, financial, exotic financial instruments, and actually Wall Street's power is so now disproportionate, it actually has the ability to manipulate those other sectors in ways that it didn't have in the past. Now, some of this started with Ronald Reagan, but I would say here tonight that the administration that did more to put Wall Street in that position than any other administration in my lifetime was Bill Clinton's administration.
You know, It's true that Wall Street doesn't seem to invest in corporations anymore that make anything. No. They seem to invest mainly in things that make money.
Or shift money, or yes, buy and sell money, or take money and package it. You know, you basically, if you think about what the 2008 crash was about, it was in the at the most pernicious edge of that knife, you had people who were financial advisors selling financial exotic financial instruments to their clients that they knew were phony, that they knew the yes, fundamentals were not correct. And those were packaged debts, usually mortgage securities. So what you – well, instead of just, you know, I'm Mr. Jim Stewart, and I go down to my local Frank Capra Bank, and I talk to Bob, the guy who runs Frank Capra Bank, and I say, you know, Bob, I'd like to buy a home. And he goes, well, you know, Jim, I've known you since you were a boy, and I see you around, and let's help you get into a home for you and Betty and the three kids, and then the dog Spot. And so you get this mortgage, and you know this guy, and you know what? He actually goes down to the local drugstore, and at the cash register, you see him two or three times a week when he's buying licorice from you or whatever it is. Those days are gone. And now what happens is those mortgages, once they get established, get packaged together and sold to other people. And there was a period at which mortgages were being handed out like licorice, like Halloween candy, right? And those things were being repackaged and sold to other people, and then sold to yet another person, and then sold to yet another financial
And under Obama, none of these people were arrested or charged or put on trial or went to jail. So let me get back to the business of Bernie Sanders. And do you think he's going to be the next Dennis Kucinich or Ron Paul, who gets the hopes up of individuals who want some kind of change, and then he'll just disappear? Why do you think he is running?
Well, I think he's running to put issues – I'm just going to take him at face value and say he's okay, there to put issues on the table. But what it does for Hillary is it allows her to truck a little bit to the left, but have somebody who the media can call a wackadoodle to the left of her and say, well, you see, I'm willing to go a little bit to the left, but I'm more moderate than the wackadoodle next to me. See, I'm an electable alternative where you get a little bit of Bernie, but you get an electable woman. So you get to elect the first woman in the history of the United States, and you get a moderate who can compete in the general. And, oh, by the way, I agree with a lot of what Bernie says, but I'm not a socialist. And well, so it's a win-win.
Joe, the one whom you cannot call a wackadoodle, who is a major force in cultural America, in industrial America, during the height of the Iraq War. And I got to just put that in pause a minute. Do you know that you obviously do know, there is a debate committee in this country that sets up the debates on CNN or ABC or wherever they hold them between the Democratic candidates and the Republican candidates. This committee is privately owned.
Right.
And when Ralph Nader was forming a third party and making a legitimate run, having to take almost every one of his cases to a state Supreme Court and then the United States Supreme Court, he tried to storm one of these debates on CNN with a few hundred followers, and they wanted to arrest him. There should be nothing like a private debate committee telling Americans who should be running for president.
Look at the two-party system as a bicycle, and the bicycle has handlebars, and on one handlebar there's a red tassel, and on the other handlebar there's a blue tassel, and sometimes the bike goes a little bit to the right, and sometimes it goes to the left, but pretty much the bike is the party, and the bike is going to go where the bike wants to go, and it may go to the left or the right a little bit, but it's going to go where it wants to go, and that's really what the two-party system is. Many people have said it. It's not original to me that the Republicans and the Democrats are two wings of the same party. And the party is really beholden to its benefactors. And its primary benefactors are the big money interests on Wall Street. And now you have billionaires who have their super PACs. And they can just basically front a campaign out of their own pockets, which is what Sheldon Adelson does, and the Koch brothers, Tom Steyer on the left. He's a big, billionaire who's an environmentalist. He's doing it a little bit too. That's where we are now. And in terms of grassroots political organizing, John, you remember? I remember this. I'll never forget it. There was actually a little bit of suspense at the 1980 Democratic Convention, because there was a possibility that at the convention, Edward Kennedy could have made a move. And now you can't imagine any kind of scenario in which a convention is anything but a giant infomercial.
The only time I had a little slight hope when Ron Paul was making noises, and Ron Paul was filling up auditoriums when Democratic and Republican candidates couldn't get half a house. They never covered Ron Paul, but the time I really got hyped up, because again, it was like a Jimmy Stewart movie, was when Ross Perot, who paid for his own time, was on stage with Poppy Bush and Bill Clinton, and he had these charts about NAFTA.
Yep.
And he pointed at each one. He pointed at Bush, then he pointed at Clinton, and he pointed at the audience and said, if you vote for either one of these men, they will sign NAFTA and destroy your jobs. And he was right.
And he was – and look, Ross Perot, I know that he's another one of these guys that the mainstream media has put quotation marks around. Wackadoodle, right? We like to use conspiracy theorists or call about these crazy guys in politics. I would have to say that Ross Perot was the last dangerous man in American presidential politics. John, you know the history of America, the other side of the history of America, because of your incredible expertise on the Kennedy assassination. But when Ross Perot dropped out and said, I've gotten good information that something's going to happen to my daughter's wedding, and yes, I can't put my – of course something happened. And people do not know that Ross Perot's arch enemy in American politics throughout a huge portion of his life was a guy named George Herbert Walker Bush. These guys despise one another, because Ross Perot, after making his money, he was at IBM and then EDS – and he made a lot of money, and he was always a patriot. And when POWs and MIAs were a big issue in Vietnam, and, we just had the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, a lot of talk of, looking back at the lessons of Vietnam. Well, one of the things that came out of
– And the Kent State shootings.
And the Kent State shootings just happened, that anniversary passing. Ross Perot actually funded his own private mercenary rescue missions for POWs inside Vietnam. Well, when Reagan came into office, and people don't remember this either, that Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush did not like each other either. Ronald Reagan could not stand George Herbert Walker Bush. Do you remember the famous, I paid for this microphone, right, in New Hampshire, I think that was 1979. Yeah. And Nelson, the story goes, is that Nelson Rockefeller actually forced George Herbert Walker Bush onto the ticket at the convention. Ronald Reagan was not going to put George Herbert Walker Bush on the ticket, and Rockefeller said, "No, I'm twisting your arm. You got to do this, or I'm going to break with you, and you'll never be president." So, when Reagan became president, POWs and MIAs were one of his little pet issues. America, let's close the books on Vietnam. I'm going to invade Grenada and try and kill the Vietnam syndrome. Blah blah blah. But he made Ross Perot his POW czar. And Ross Perot's point of contact inside the White House was actually George Herbert Walker Bush, the vice president, because George Herbert Walker Bush, people don't know this generally, was really the head of all intelligence operations inside that White House. His saying, "I was out of the loop."
He was CIA.
Because he was CIA director. At a very crucial time, he was a CIA director. And actually, I went in and read the logs on the Kennedy assassination more than any CIA director, even though he was there for just less than a year. We could talk about that and the coming of Admiral Stansfield Turner, when Carter put in Stansfield Turner, and Stansfield Turner fired about 100 of Poppy Bush's covert loyalists, and they ended up populating his campaign to run for the presidency and ended up being part of the war, part of Iran-Contra, and so on and so forth. But anyway, that's an aside. You know, Perot started going to poking around Southeast Asia with you know, the sort of the power of the U.S. government at his disposal a little bit. And in a, in an interview with Monica Jensen Stevenson, arranged by her, she was a producer for 60 Minutes. He went on camera and said, I faced George Herbert Walker Bush. And I said, George, I keep going to Southeast Asia looking for our boys, and all I find is our boys involved in drug dealing.
Excuse me a second, Joe. I want to take a quick break right now. And when I come back, I know you were really good friends with Naomi Klein because she's featured prominently in that wonderful documentary that you did that it also included Chris Hedges, who I said is going to be on in a couple of weeks. Let's take a quick break now. Sure. And when we come back, I want to get to Naomi Klein and the business of money in America. Okay. We'll be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
I'd like to thank George Knapp, the best host on Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon, as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some of them from some very famous people. Also, while you're there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook, Volume 1, with a terrific intro by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place, and find something it'll make you laugh or think or angry. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. We're talking to Joe Satilli, who does the best researched and written newsletter that is out in America. I mean, it's deserving of a Pulitzer. It's called News Vandal. And Joe is the brightest person I know, and you can hear right now, when it comes to talking about the American economy and talking about journalism, talking about politics. You can all hear that right now. Joe, we're back. My computer went blank, so I missed this question from a listener. Do you want to pick it up for me?
Sure, here. This is from Krongarden, Virginia. Now, I'm going to assume this is not A.B. Buzzy Krongard, the infamous CIA agent, longtime CIA agent, who was involved in putting the put options on United and American before 9/11 through Deutsche Bank. So I'm going to assume it's not Buzzy Krongard, because I don't think he would ask this question. But he says, Joe, what do you think about the future of the Fourth Estate with respect to investigative journalism? Is investigative journalism dead, and that's all caps dead, by virtue of self-censorship for access? I actually – here's a surprise, a surprising take. I think this is the golden age of investigative journalism. I think there is more investigative journalism happening now, more great investigative journalism happening now. It's just not happening in the mainstream media. You have to go out and search for it. It's happening in places like The Intercept. It's happening at Reveal.org, the Center for Investigative Journalism, the Center for Public Integrity, ProPublica. There are so many places doing great investigative journalism. The thing is that you're not going to find it at CBS, ABC, NBC, or Fox. You're not going to find it at CNN or MSNBC. You're probably not going to find a lot of it at mainstream newspapers like the New York Times, although the New York Times occasionally has something really interesting and biting. You will find some good investigative stuff happening at Bloomberg Online, but you really have to go and search for it, which, John, is why I do the newsletter and why I look at a couple hundred, couple 300 or 400 websites every week. I get up at 5 a.m. and I spend 3 hours looking at multiple sources, hundreds and hundreds of sources I have at my disposal, and I try and come up with those things. And not everything that I put on the News Vandal rundown I agree with, but that's the point, because they're, you know, it's I aggregate and you decide is the idea. And but there is incredible investigative journalism. If you think about all the things that we do know, part of the reason we know the things we know is because people have sacrificed to get us that information. The final thing I will say about that, even though this is a golden age for investigative journalism, this is not a golden age for journalists. It's very hard to make a living. It's very hard to get top ramen in your belly if you're an investigative journalist, but it somehow has not stopped people from doing a lot of the hard work.
How can people get your News Vandal?
Just email me at info@newsvandal.com. That's newsvandal.com. If you just go to newsvandal.com, type it in, the website will pop up and you'll see in the upper right-hand corner, what is the story rundown? You can click it there. But just any email to info@newsvandal.com with sign up in the subject line, and I will get you on the newsletter.
Okay, I want to get back to money. Bill Clinton gets paid how much a speech?
$500,000. And actually, that $500,000 marker was hit when there was a deal going on with this guy, Frank Giustra, that I mentioned,
right.
A Canadian guy. There was a Canadian company that was involved in a uranium mining deal to get a uranium mining takeover. They were sort of involved as a middleman in this uranium mine takeover. Uranium mines in America being purchased by a Russian uranium mining company. And since it's a national security asset, multiple agencies had to sign off, including the State Department. And when the Russian company announced that they were going to go into this takeover mode to try and get these American uranium mines, the first thing they did was offer Bill Clinton a speaking engagement at $500,000, which I think at that time was nearly double his usual speaking fee.
Oh my God, is that offensive? Speaking,
but there's no smoking gun. It just looks bad. John, don't you realize that? It just looks bad. It's kind of, it looks as bad as a stain on a blue dress.
That's funny. Speaking of dresses, I know Naomi Klein is crazy about you, loves your work, but I haven't heard her commenting on the state of politics in America or the state of the economy for the last 5 or 6 months, which seems very unusual for her. What is she up to?
Well, I think after the shock doctrine, which was her her political sort of treatise, it's an amazing thing, which shows how you know, you use military campaigns and economic shocks to alter a country's paradigms, their systems, and then you can go in and exploit them financially. And you know, her story, I'll just tell a little bit of the story I read that she wrote in The Guardian about why she changed horses in midstream, it would seem, to focus on the climate. And she's writing about climate change and about environmental degradation. It's because she went and saw firsthand what happened after the deep water rig exploded in the BP deep water rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico and despoiled the Gulf of Mexico. Now, you know, there's a rosy scenario about how the Gulf of Mexico is recovered, but it actually hasn't really recovered. A lot of that oil is on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico,
But certainly that can't be as bad as Fukushima and what Fukushima is doing to the Pacific.
Well, but see, here you go. I mean, this is – we are – I think what she saw was that Fukushima is, I guess, slightly different in there in that you have the government of Japan extremely complicit with TEPCO, and TEPCO is the company that – ran Fukushima, and you have a lot of those problems there. And Fukushima, you know, John, I'm kind of mixed on Fukushima. I'm going to tell you, Fukushima in northern Japan, that area, mm-hmm. is a nightmare. It's highly contaminated. It's going to be a multi-generational problem, and they're already seeing leukemia spikes and other issues. There are millions of gallons of radioactive water going into the Pacific Ocean every month, because they are still trying to keep that thing cool. That's the old China syndrome. Remember that, where you're going to have a meltdown and it could go all the way down to China? That goes through the middle of the earth out the other side. They're still trying to contain that. In terms of radiation appearing here on the west coast of California, there has been – the radioactive isotopes have shown up, particularly off of the coast of Vancouver, British Columbia. In terms of its impact – I would say at this point here in the United States, the impact is not nearly what the impact of the deep water oil spill was on the Gulf of Mexico in terms of ecosystems. But I would assume that she's quite concerned about Fukushima too, because in a sense, the nuclear industry is yet another one of these profitable enterprises out of which comes a complete and total utter disregard for the impact and the cost of that profit-making enterprise, which is why I think she turned her attention to climate and climate change, which she believes cannot be rectified as long as we have the form of capitalism we do.
In other words, she feels that climate change, which is really happening, is not weather modification, but is natural modification because of what we're doing to the planet?
Well, let's look at it this way. Here's an interesting thing. There is a great deal of science coming out now, and I've been putting it on – it's just starting to break. A number of studies showing that one of the reasons why we have such a massive increase of carbon dioxide into the air is not just because of the massive amounts of hydrocarbons human beings are burning – coal and oil, gas, so on, cars, and to create electricity – but it's also because, here's an interesting thing, human beings have been over-nitrating our soils. And basically what I'm talking about are nitrate fertilizers that get pumped into the soil to artificially inflate, artificially fertilize farmland. Well, interesting to note that these nitrating fertilizers are made from petrochemicals. It's actually the oil business that created the Green Revolution in the 1950s, and the Green Revolution was predicated on artificially pumping up soils with nitrate fertilizers, and what that has done has eliminated the natural process by which carbon is sucked into the soil, and that's how the soil would feed plants. That's the natural system. But by over-nitrating it with petrochemical fertilizers from the oil industry, it has eliminated the ability of the soils to absorb 40 5% of the carbon in the atmosphere. In other words, if we could just stop nitrating the soils with petrochemical fertilizers, the soils might be able to absorb over the next few decades 40% of the carbon that is causing global warming. So here you have the oil companies making money on two things. It's actually a lose-lose. For them, it's a win-win because they're profiting off of the fertilizers and off of the oil they're selling. But this is the kind of capitalistic machine that cares only about immediate profit and offshores, offloads the environmental cost to all of us. This is one of the things, is there sort of an engine of the engine of profits is often a process of moving the costs to other people. You maximize profits by reducing cost. So if
Joe, what it is that you're doing, you're educating us about something that is totally natural and something about which we should know, but it's something about which we hear nothing. Now,
nothing.
When Naomi wrote that book about disaster capitalism or whatever it was she called her wonderful book, she got all kinds of press. Every time I turned on C-SPAN, there was this wonderful Naomi Klein. She was almost at every college campus in the country. She must be saying what it is that you're saying, but I haven't heard her in this country.
Well, here's an interesting thing. You know, it has occurred to me, and this latest book is called "This Changes Everything," and
is
it didn't get.
Book?
This is the latest book, and this is about capitalism and climate change and the environment. Has gotten almost no press, as you pointed out. And here's an interesting thing, John. And I was never a big fan of Al Gore, and you mentioned NAFTA and Al Gore. I'd be fascinated to find out what he thinks about how he goaded Ross Perot on Larry King into helping him make his case for NAFTA, because NAFTA really, you know, the thing that Ross Perot got wrong about NAFTA, it wasn't that there was going to be a giant sucking sound of jobs into Mexico. There were the maquiladora that popped up, these factories along the border with California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas, where you had these factories. But really what happened was that the big ag industry was able to go into Mexico and destroy the small farming businesses there. And what did that do? Well, all the small farmers who lost their farms as a result of NAFTA ended up doing what? Going to Iowa and working as undocumented immigrants on factory farms in Iowa and factory farms in North Carolina, and became the easily controllable, illegal, low-paid, easy to manipulate labor force that allowed Big Ag to increase their profits exponentially. But to get to Naomi Klein, this is not something that is very popular with the people who fund television. And if you look at who's funding television, it's the American Petroleum Institute. And I just want to postulate something about Al Gore. Isn't it, you know, if you think about it, we're talking about Bush and Clinton, and they're really two parts of the same whole. Ultimately, Wall Street's going to win. It's either going to be 55 miles an hour with Hillary or 75 miles an hour with Jeb. But you're still going down the road with either one of them. Nobody's going to put on the brakes like Elizabeth Warren would. I have to wonder what it was about Al Gore. If we would just sort of take for granted that both parties are beholden to the same interests, what was it about Al Gore that the system was willing to openly steal an election and run the risk of the people not being willing to accept a stolen election? What was so dangerous about him that they had to have him out and they had to have George W. Bush? Now, you could talk about 9/11 and what followed.
Well, the sidebar here to Gore, you know, he had hired 21 attorneys because he was convinced he was going to have to challenge the election. And after the Supreme Court awarded it to Bush, Gore stopped. He decided he wasn't going to sue.
Because I think that somebody said something along the way. Look, that election was stolen before any vote was cast. We know that. investigative reporters like Greg Palast that found 50.
Why did they want to get rid of Gore so badly then?
That's the question I have, and I'm going to tell you something. I collect old magazines, as you like to know, and I found a magazine. It's called Analog, Science Fact and Science Fiction. And they had science fiction stories from Isaac Asimov and others, and then they would have science fact articles in them. And I found an article from 1978 about climate change. 1978. Wow. And you read what was being written by scientists about climate change in 1978, and it is wholly accurate and predictive of where we are right now today. And there's a funny line at the end of this article. It says, well, if we just – all we need is a little bit of political will, and it's very easy now to make the political decisions we need to make sure that this carbon issue, which could become this big problem, doesn't become a problem. It's not really – it's not that hard to do. Well, it never happened. And it never happened because why? Because there's a lot of money at stake for Saudi Arabia, for Halliburton, for Chevron, Condi Rice, Chevron, Dick Cheney, Halliburton, the Bush family, the Saudis, a lot of money at stake.
Well, you gave our friend in Virginia an uplift, and you gave me an uplift too when you said that there was never a better time for investigative journalists now, except it doesn't happen with the mainstream and journalists can't really earn a living. So there is hope for journalism in a way.
In a way.
Is there hope for America in a way?
I don't know. It's very – here's another contrary point of view. A lot of people despair of the millennials. I don't despair of the millennials. The millennials are less consumer-oriented. I think the Occupy movement was successful. All we talk about now is income inequality and the 99% and the 1%. People criticize the Occupy movement, but think about how it's changed our discussion. And I think young people, they are not as bought in to the idea that owning a big screen TV and a big car is what it's all about. And that's what gives me hope, because we never got around to debt, John, and we never got around to this consumer culture dying and the fact that this economy is completely paper thin. There's nothing real about this economy. But I think these millennials kind of understand it, and I think it's part of They are the most indebted generation in the history of America in terms of student loan debt, and I think that they're starting to see through it.
Do you know that 2 years ago, students in Quebec, in Canada, were rioting and burning down buildings because of the student debt imposed upon them, which is only a fraction of what is happening right to American students, and American students do nothing, and their parents do nothing.
Well, because their parents are invested in the system. And I think, on some level, we're dealing with the baby boom generation and the lasting impact of the baby boom generation for all the good and all the ill. Hey, a lot of great music came out of the 60s, but a lot of debt was acquired. And, you know, when the baby boom generation embraced Ronald Reagan and then got one of their own in there and Bill Clinton – it was really about what? It was about let's get the best lifestyle we can on credit cards, debt be damned, the future be damned, and now the future is here.
Well, in my future, Joe, I'm going to have you back again. I could talk to you for hours and hours, and you should have your own show on network radio or network television. You should be on C-SPAN. You're like Chris Hedges. You should be all over the place. You should be giving lectures at universities. Again, we're talking to Joseph Tilley. Tell us again how they can get your News Vandal.
Just email me at info, at News Vandal, spelled just like it sounds, NESWVANDAL.com, newsvandal.com. Sign up in the subject line and you'll be on the newsletter mailing list.
Joe, again, thank you so much for being here. In a couple of weeks, our guest is going to be, I was going to say the brightest man in America, but I've just talked to Joe, so I may have to say the second brightest man in America.
Oh, no, Chris
Chris Hedges. Can't wait to talk to him. I've been waiting to interview him for about 3 or 4 years now. Again, Joe, thank you so much, and I'll talk to you again shortly.
Good Always night. An honor, John.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. Complete desire, a sunny sunny, 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 I love you.